That was Big Country with In a Big Country. Go figure. Their only number one hit song in America. I don't know if it's Jonathan Evason's favorite song, but Jonathan Evason, are you on the line anyways?
Yeah, I do own that record.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm in my garage.
You want to go put it on?
We could just The Crossing, right?
Yeah, we could just listen to it again. That's it.
No, that's all right.
Okay.
I got to admit, it doesn't get a whole... My best friend gave it to me. He loves it.
Okay. So your best friend's just trying to support you and make sure that you listen to a diverse range of music.
Oh, I'm already diverse. It's just what I do is, I have all my buddies out to my garage, and so they bring records they want to hear, because I may not necessarily buy them. I buy, Rush. You know how I feel about Rush, and I know how you feel about Rush.
Yes, sir.
I've got 4 Rush albums, just because I respect my friends who like Rush. I never play them unless my friends that like Rush are around.
Did you buy the Rush albums? Did you buy them, or your friends bought them?
I get it. I just don't think that, four musical virtuosos necessarily makes a good ensemble, you know?
There's only 3, Jonathan.
Well, whatever. It sounds like 4, all those drums.
Yeah, see, that's the magic of the sound. It's that's a wall of sound with only 3, kind of pencil neck dudes. Although Neil wasn't really a pencil neck, I guess, but yeah.
I do love them and I respect them. I just don't like the music. For a minute, I start liking it, and then Gary Lee starts singing. I'm like, I'm out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. That's, I once tricked a girlfriend by just playing all of Rush's instrumental songs. She's like, God, I really like this band. They sound really good. And I just showed her the cover, and it was like, oh, God. Oh, man. You tricked me. Well.
Yeah, they're great musicians. We disagree on a lot of stuff, Paul. I like you, but. You drink those hard seltzers, and I think that's...
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's one of our plans is to rate those today, is to see what your favorite spiked seltzer is, Jonathan, and it's probably beer, I would imagine, is if we can call beer a spiked seltzer. I mean, it's the same process, right?
Sort of, except one includes potentially a diabetic coma, and the other one does not.
You mean beer includes the diabetic coma, right?
Because no, the seltzer's all sweet, right?
No, they only have like 1 gram of sugar. They're not sweet at all.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought it was more like one of those sissy ciders or the California cooler type thing.
You got to have me over to your garage. I will bring multiple cases of spiked seltzer for you. It only has 1 gram of sugar. So here, let me tell you this. Reformed beer drinker here. And I'm not just a drunk. I'm somebody who likes to consume liquid, whether it be water, coffee, what have you. I just want to intake liquid at monumental paces. That is what my body wants. So
yeah, I was like that when I was a smoker.
Back when I
smoked cigarettes, man, I always had a big cup of something, like some Crystal Light or something, just like 24/7. Just like a big, dude, my mouth was always getting so dry,
Yeah. And you would start coughing and stuff. And you need something to wash it down with. Well, I've quit smoking. I'm kind of smoking again. Sorry, Mom. But I promise to quit again soon. But I feel like I was drinking the same amount of water being a non-smoker too. Not to humble brag or anything, but
Well, that's pretty impressive.
Thank you. But seriously, it has less sugar than beer. It has way less sugar. So, all those nights drinking like a 12-pack of Rainiers and then, trying to fight a sandwich board. I could have drank, I could have felt so much better in the morning, I guess is my point. Maybe less bruises.
Yeah, but does it have sodium?
No.
I'll bet you it does.
No, it doesn't.
I know you got a 6-pack stash there in the studio.
No, that would be illegal. The FCC doesn't need to know about that.
Okay. Well, I think there's sodium. I beg to differ. And I think there's sodium, which means it's not going to hydrate you. Otherwise, I like the idea of it, getting your water with your alcohol. You could do that with scotch and water, too. But I like that idea. But if there's any sodium in it, that's out the window.
Right.
It won't hydrate you.
Right. Defeats the purpose. I mean, I've got ones now that have antioxidants in them and vitamin C. So every time I drink one. Oh, and there's another brand that has electrolytes, like Gatorade.
Okay, that sounds. But I just okay. I mean, good for you. That's good.
I just need to win this.
A glass, some ice, and some tequila, and a decent, kind of pale ale. None of these IPAs or a lager. Just something I can swill in large quantities.
Are you an IPA drinker? Do you like IPAs a lot?
No.
Interesting. Yeah. What's up with that? Why? When did IPAs become this? When did like just completely destroying your taste buds with hops become the all like what taste is for beer? I don't understand that.
I think it happened in the mid 2000s. I remember. I mean, Ballard Bitter was one of the first IPAs I remember, and that was early. That was even like late 90s. But you know, that beer is all hopped up just for preservation purposes. When they used to ship it across the Indian Ocean, they'd hop it up to preserve it. That was the only reason. They never did it for taste in the first place. I just think the hops are such a bully. And I go into Safeway and there's like two beers I can drink. They got 50 beers, but like 46 of them are IPAs.
Yeah, I mean, that's all. And is that what people want, really? Or is it just sort of like we've confused ourselves and made us think that beer actually tastes like something else? When I'd rather drink a Budweiser than another new IPA that also...
I think what you have to take into consideration, Paul, is not everyone's a rummy like you and I. I think some people might just drink two beers. So the idea of having it be an 8.5% alcoholic beverage instead of a 4.5%, they could find that advantageous to them. But I'm not that way. I'm like you. I like to consume a lot of liquid. And in my case, that would be, you know, like I like Bass or I like British ale. And like, I can put away like 14 of those in a night and I feel great in the morning.
Can you even find Bass ale over here? Because I drank that a lot when I lived in Boston. I mean, I swear I drink that every night. Promotion to Bass here, but like... Where do you find? I haven't seen
nowhere
it.
Nowhere on the peninsula. There is only two beer distributors on the entire peninsula, I have learned, and nobody, not a single store anywhere, carries Bass on the Olympic Peninsula. They did up until about 3 years ago. I could find it at a couple places, like the T&C on Bainbridge and the Central Market would have it, but now nothing. So I just have my city friends or my nephews grab a case of it when they come over.
Nice. So you do have the hookup, and you don't need somebody to send you like eight cases of Bass Ale right now.
They can do that. I'll go live with my address if somebody wants to send me eight cases of Bass.
Well, maybe don't go live with your address. I don't want to be responsible in case it's something else than Bass Ale that comes to you. But I guess tell me where you got the taste for that. Was that in Seattle? We're talking to Jonathan Evison, by the way, famous beer drinker and Pacific Northwest roustabout. And I don't know, what other titles would you give yourself, Jonathan?
I don't know, Paul. I'll just try to be humble here.
Okay.
Ex-former talk radio show host.
Were you really a talk radio show host?
Yeah, I was a syndicated talk radio host in the early 2000s. Outrageous talk radio, 100.7 The Buzz.
Oh, my God. Okay, so I haven't read it, but I knew that All About Lulu has something about talk radio in it, and I was going to ask you if you'd ever seen the movie or the play Eric Bogosian's Talk Radio.
Oh, hell yeah. That was a great movie. I saw, did you ever see his monologue with the three characters?
No.
Where he's just sitting tossing the football. It's like the guy from Jersey tossing a football with another guy, and he does all the voices. And he goes, it was just a one-man play, and then like three acts. It was great. I actually had Bogosian on my records, or on my radio show back then. It must have been like 2002 or something. Yeah, he was on my show because he was touring because he had written a novel. Mm. I was always trying to get novelists on because, you know, I'm a novelist, and, you know, you don't hear a lot of novelists on the radio. You hear writers, you usually hear... nonfiction writers, you know, somebody with a platform, something topical. But so I was always trying to book novelists. And Eric Bogosian was sort of a novelist, I guess.
Playwright, novelist.
It was a thriller about a sniper in a stadium, as I recall, or something. Mm. It wasn't great. But I loved him. I had a lot of respect for him.
So in the play you're talking about where he plays all three characters, that's what Oliver Stone's movie was based on. The was Talk Radio?
Oh, no, they're different things. They're different animals, Eric Bogosian animals.
Gotcha, okay.
Yeah, no. But actually, you know, talk radio, my program director, her name is Chris Olinger. She was the real talk show host that it was named Alex somebody that Bogosian's character is based on was named Alex somebody. And his partner was Chris Olinger, and she was my program director at
Outrageous Talk Radio, 100.7 The Buzz.
Oh, man.
But she used to be in Denver. She was an on-air talent, and she was her partner, the guy that got shot, the real guy.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's so fascinating. Like I read that story. I remember just being obsessed with that movie. When I was in high school, I rented it from the Northgate Public Library, and I just kept checking it out and just watching it over and over again because it, you know, it was gritty and it was fun, but it was like I hadn't really seen many movies like that that were so exciting and thrilling, but had like one took place in one or two scenes or one or two settings, you know. The way it created tension.
Basically the studio and the parking lot, right?
That's it.
I haven't seen the movie in 25 years, probably, but that's about the last time I saw Rocket's Red Glare. He was kind of big back then, you know, the character actor Rocket's Red Glare. He's the guy that plays the guy that kills Eric Bogosian in the parking lot.
Oh, cool. No, I didn't know. And his name is Rocket's Red Glare?
Yeah.
Wow.
I should see that. I haven't seen that movie in years. I should see it.
Watch it again. I'm remembering there is like one or two scenes where they leave the station. But anyways, so wait, I want to know more about you as a talk radio host. Because here's something, you know, I just started this show June 5th or something. So, you know, and I'm going to have 100,000 more episodes of this. But there's a part of me that wants to do like a day where I'm doing, you know, call-in, traditional, standard talk radio. And just, you know, able to talk to whoever calls in, especially in COVID times. I mean, like, I can't have people in the studio. So my thinking is like, oh, if I declare it talk radio, how do I ensure people call in? So when you were a host, I mean, and you didn't have people coming on or didn't have people calling in, you know, what would you do? Would you like get producers to call in, or how would you make sure you had or maybe that wasn't a problem for you? Tell me about that.
Well, I was reaching 250,000, you know, listeners at once, you know what I mean? So it was pretty, you're casting a really wide net, so it's pretty easy to get callers. I don't know, you know, I think you need a big pool to assure that, you know, I mean, I don't know how many listeners KPTZ has.
I think we have about six listeners right now. Yeah.
When I went camping last weekend, some guy saw my KPTZ bumper stickers with, "That's my favorite station."
Whoa.
And I said, yeah. I used to do a show there for about 5 minutes.
I know
then
you
COVID
were.
Hit.
You were doing a show. You were like alternating with Buzzy Donahue, right, or something like that.
Yeah. I only did like two or three episodes, but I still got an entire. I've got about 300 records here that I plan to play in future episodes. I still haven't put back in the stacks because I'm waiting for, you know, after this is all over, just do a guest spot now and then.
Yeah. No. And you're wanted, and you know the station's waiting for you, basically. I'll say that. I mean, you know, whether or not...
Say hi to Buzzy for me, too. I love Buzzy. She's awesome.
I will do. So when you had your talk radio show, one last question about that. Did you have a topic for the day, or was it just whatever people wanted to talk about?
Yeah, well, here's one of the reasons I got out of talk radio. It was awful. I mean, sublimely... and totally awful, because it was outrageous talk radio. So it was like shock jock stuff. I used to go on before Tom Likas.
Oh, God.
Really? Oh. Who was just a complete toad.
I grew up listening to him. Hated him.
I mean, the guy used to be like a liberal talk show pundit. You could swallow him then, but then he just became, his whole platform became misogyny. But so I would have a producer, and he was just awful. They were like, call, you know, they would tell me to call my female callers chicks. I'm like, or ask my female callers if they're hot. And, you know, I'd be getting this stuff on the teleprompter from my, you know, producer in the other booth. And I just, you know, fly him a bird, like, you know, screw you, dude. I'm not going to do that. Then I'd wait until I got, like, the police chief of Tacoma on for another story, and I'd ask him if he was hot. And so
yes.
I don't think I really screwed up a chance to probably be a pretty, to have a decent career in talk radio. That was also the time when, you know, there's a lot of consolidation going on. CBS and Viacom and these big companies are buying everybody up. Local talent was disappearing. I had some overtures from like Dallas and Detroit, which are both awful cities, but big talk radio markets, like top 10 radio markets. But there's just no way I was going to do that. It's kind of a journeyman's career. And I just didn't like the idea that I couldn't, you know, there was times when I got to run like a morning zoo, and that was fun. Like I'd get my guests, I'd get all my rock and roll friends or my friends from Pearl Jam or my friends, you know, from the music scene in, and I just have kind of a zoo, and we talk about evergreen subjects and things like that, and that was fun. But I didn't like the topical nature.
Yeah,
I came to have almost because of the demographic of the station, I came to have what I would say is kind of a healthy contempt for my own listeners. I didn't really want to hear their opinions, and so when you do topical stuff, it's like I don't really care what some jerk thinks about some political, you know what I mean? Some guy don't, I, you know, some guy wouldn't want to have a beer with. I don't want to hear his not well-formed opinion over the air. So I would tend to, I always believe that people had good stories. You know, people have good stories. They don't have to have good opinions, but almost everybody has a good story. So I always try to do like more evergreen topics and just, you know, mine my callers for good stories, you know, because people have experiences, but I don't necessarily want to hear their, you know, misinformed opinions on, you know, topical political matters. I think
yeah,
our recent epic puts a really fine point on why that might be, you know?
Right. And your producers, meanwhile, wanted you to just hit on women and get into fights with the male callers, it sounds like.
Yeah. No, so I did. See, it all started for me because I had produced a show that was called Chicken Not Stirred. It was like a variety comedy show. It was like the old National Lampoon Radio Hour. And I did it with my friend Scotty Crane over, and we recorded the stuff in advance over at Soundhouse. And, you know, we had like a pool of 30 voiceover talents. And I mean, the show took like 90 man hours to produce. And it was a half hour long, and it played on Saturday nights in like 20 markets. So like we were all over the country, but I was making like $2,500 a month. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I didn't realize when I got into radio that it was a Monday through Friday drive time driven. You know what I mean? So all the program directors were always trying to go, oh, this is great. We love the show. So much talent here, blah, blah, blah. But we want you to be on the mornings. We want you to do middays. We want you to do daily radio because that's where the money is.
Mm.
And so that's when I made that transition. And it was just never the same. I love producing. I mean, as a writer, I'm pretty proud of some of the stuff I wrote for radio. You know, prouder than I am of my screenplays or anything like that. Mm. Anything but my novels. Mm. I was pretty proud of it. But like the talk radio thing is a different animal.
Yeah.
You know, you're at KPTV. You can talk about whatever you want and engage your community however you want. You don't have some wiseacre, producer telling you to ask me if I'm hot over there.
Yeah. Well, so are you hot?
Yes. I think so. 25 years ago.
Well, maybe we should ask your wife. No, wait, we won't. Now I'm getting there. Well, my producer is not looking at me right now. In fact, my producer would say she's not my producer, but she also gives me great ideas sometimes. So yeah. And yeah, that's what this show is all about, is really just sort of like, let's say hi to the community, you know, let's have conversations about real things. We can talk about important topics, but we can also talk about, why you're so wrong hating on Spike Seltzy. That's, you know, that can be a topic too. So we're back on Filter. I'm Paul Reiss talking to Jonathan Evison, local Pacific Northwest roustabout and former talk radio host, lover of beer and breeder of rabbits and children and lover of Lauren is your wife's name?
Yeah.
And let's see. Yeah, that's those are the titles I'm going to give you. Also author. And
oh, come on. What about New York Times best-selling author?
New York Times best-selling author.
There you go.
Not a Pulitzer Prize winner yet. Man Booker yet, but New York Times best-selling author. Great review of several of your books in the New York Times Book Review, which is one of my favorite sections to read. I almost never read the books that are reviewed, but I will read the reviews for some reason. Before we go off of radio, you said something that about you're like, you know, most proud of your novels, of course, being a great novelist, but, the things that you wrote for radio are like kind of your second pride. And I'm just curious about that because what kind of stuff were you writing? Narrative, fiction? Were you writing, what kind of things were you writing for radio?
Well, it was like the National Lampoon Radio Hour meets the Goon Show. You know, the old Goon Show with Peter Sellers, which was it was basically like a situational comedy.
So
it took place with the radio host doing their show remotely in a dive bar. And then we'd break away to spoofs, you know, commercials, features, stuff like that. It was very production heavy. We worked with a lot of great vocal talent. It came at a time that was very unpolitically correct. And, you know, I mean, this is the age of South Park, basically. And you know, I mean, so some of the, I've gone back and listened to some of the material is really well produced. But it doesn't age necessarily that well.
Gotcha.
The dialogue,
yeah,
culturally was different then. It's just that you just kind of cringe sometimes when you hear it. Some of it I'm still proud of, but some of it I'm like, oh god, pretty bad.
Right.
But then it's all culturally relative to the time too. I mean, that's when like shocking somebody actually generally was like a thing. You know what I mean? Now we're beyond shock. I mean.
Well, maybe not beyond, but there's different levels of shock that are acceptable versus what used to be. Do you know about the death of comedy, which is a show on KPTZ?
I do not.
So it's really similar to what you're talking about. Michael Grady and Nat Danger produce this. It's like a radio play, but it's radio sketch comedy, and it's on its latest season. I think it's the fourth season of it. And they, of course, it doesn't air till 10 PM because the humor is, as you might imagine, a little more risque. So they need to fly away. They need to stay out of the FCC's children listening to radio hours. But it's really well done. And if you ever get the chance, check out The Death of Comedy, cause it sounds a lot like what you were doing.
Yeah, we basically had cornered the market at the time, and I quickly found out that was because nobody was stupid enough to put 90 man hours into a half-hour show that played at 9 o'clock on Saturdays. So I remember, we had this, like, fly-by-night shady syndicator at 1.2 in Portland who we found out. I started getting letters, like actual letters from the show from this one station in, like, Farmville, Florida or something. It was in, like, the Florida Panhandle. And they're like, we're really liking the show, but do you have to drop so many G-bombs? And I'm like, G-bomb, G-bomb, what is that one? I know the F-bomb. I know that, we had a lot of swearing that was bleeped out, in the studio. And we figured out it was a gospel station. They were actually playing our show on a gospel station.
Oh, God.
If you had heard, the show is really pretty raunchy. And it's like, that just tells you a little bit about the syndicator we were dealing with.
So G-bombs were God bombs, basically.
Yes, anytime we heard the
yep,
G-word.
So God.
It was offensive.
Goddamn. That's, well, at least you knew that you were, maybe you opened some minds, some hearts and minds out there, syndicated with your syndication. So, maybe not, though.
I remember you wanted to talk about the gentrification of Seattle.
Yes, no, that's exactly what I was going to jump into right now. I was just, I have written in my script, Seattle memories. We kind of came of age at different times in Seattle, you were in Bainbridge, so you were going back and forth, but you lived in Seattle too for a time as well, right?
Yeah, I used to live, I rented warehouses downtown all through the late 80s and early 90s. Back in the day, I had 3,500 square feet across from the Nightlight. It was a former dance studio, the whole second floor of 19 and a half, wow. Second Avenue. And it was 3,500 square feet. It was $1,000 a month, the entire floor of a building. We had five people living there. And there was you'd come home and yell, is anybody in here? So we were all paying $200 a month rent to live across the street from the Nightlight at, the last, for me, like the last of the great days of Seattle, early 90s.
So, and that was on 2nd Avenue? You're talking the Nightlight on 2nd, right?
Yeah, there's that building, and right across really from, Terminal Sales is on 1st, isn't it? It's same block, it was 2nd and Virginia, literally right across. So you look out the window, there's that little building there, it's like half size.
Yeah.
A normal building would probably be 6,000 square feet. This is 3,500. There's that little half building with an adjacent parking lot, if it's still that way. Yeah, that we had the whole second floor of that building was $1,000.
Oh, that's amazing.
30 cents per square foot.
And you were right next to the Moore Theater. Moore Theater was still happening then, right? Or was?
Yeah.
So just like...
Yeah, just walking to the Gibson House every night, stumbling to the Gibson House. And, the rents were still low. Seattle was great. I mean, it was even better in the early 80s. I mean, I'm of the belief that a town is at its best when the economy is not good. Art scenes tend to flourish when the economy is bad because you can get warehouse space for $1,000.
Right.
And so after the Boeing bust in the late 70s, that's when the Seattle music scene really started cooking for me. I mean, everything that became grunge then was like, the early punk scene, Metropolis and the Graven Image and Monroe's, and, you know, that was, you know, I was like 13, 14 years old in the band, and, you know, touring mainly just West Coast, but that was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so fun back then. There was like 6 all ages club at any given time.
Mm. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I only remember 2 when I was growing up. It was like Rock Candy and then DV8. I spent too much time at DV8, unfortunately.
I forgot Rock Candy was all ages.
Yeah, wasn't it all ages? It was all ages.
I don't know. I was 21 by then, so I don't remember.
You didn't notice us kids in the other in the under 21 section. Rock, and then there was can't remember the other one. But, you know, and they had the all ages. Remember the dance club ordinance that came around? Well, maybe you don't, because you were old and you were drinking and you weren't having the same problems.
Are you talking about after that shooting at I Spy or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was my friend Chris Roberts' place. Yeah. They had that gang shooting or something outside. And that was the early 90s, right?
Yep. Yep.
I remember that. Yeah. I do remember that. Before that, what we had was the fire department shut our club. We had the underage permit thing. The underage club scene just sort of died in probably, I don't know, maybe 1986 or something. I don't know. I was kind of out of the punk scene by then, but that was the end of the golden era. I would go to 3 shows a week, you know, at different venues. You know, Larry Reed, who owns Fantagraphics, had the Graven Image right down in Pioneer Square, and there was the Gray Door, and then there was the Metropolis, all of those places within a block and a half.
Yeah.
All of them having, I mean, sometimes there's 2 great shows going on a block apart from each other, and they were all ages, and you know, the scene was like the same 200 people, you know? I mean, everybody, you know, that's why I have all these friends. I mean, you know, I kicked Stoney Gossard out of my band, March of Crimes. He really wanted to be a March of Crimes, and it just wasn't working, so I kicked him out, and then he started Green River. It was a small group of people. It was really the same 150, 200 people, and they all ended up being in bands. And, you know, pretty soon in the late 80s, early 90s, a few A&R guys, I think it was a guy named Michael Goldstone or something like that, a couple A&R guys started sniffing around the Vogue and the Central and things like that, and it kind of just changed the whole consciousness of the scene, you know? Like, people were a little more self-aware. Before that, Seattle had been in this beautiful bubble, you know?
Yeah.
It was different, because I spent my summers down in the Southern California and Northern California punk scenes, because my parents were divorced, so I go down there for summers, and I go to shows at the Mabuhay Gardens and the On-Broadway and L.A. clubs, and I just noticed that the scenes there were just so stratified, you know? You had the guys with the scooters out front, and then you had your skinheads holding up one wall, and your leather punks over here, you know, I mean, it was all just so socially stratified. But in Seattle, it's like the big tall black kid was standing next to the kid with the Gilligan hat, and standing next to the girl with the black trench coat and the black eye makeup who's got a camera slung around her neck, and then like a big, big hair metal guy with a crop T-shirt and the biceps. And not only are they standing next to each other at the show, they're in a band together. So Seattle had this like very, I don't know, it's just very organic, very. It wasn't aware of the larger world.
Homogenous, not in a bad way. I mean, it sounds like everyone's. I mean, and I'm curious. Actually, I want to go back to. So, what did the scooter represent in those the stratification of Southern California music scene?
Your mod.
Oh, okay. Like straight out the 60s.
Their scooters and they're out front smoking clove cigarettes. What I meant, it was just very cliquish. Whereas Seattle, everybody was all mixed together.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And I was very aware of that, seeing both of those at one time. And I think that's what made Seattle, that scene, so special. To me, it became less special when, you know, the A&R guys started sniffing around and all my friends started becoming rock stars, which was exciting and amazing for them. You know what I mean? But the scene at that point was different. There was much more self-consciousness about Seattle's place in the larger musical world. It wasn't, you know what I mean?
Well, and I remember being really like, when I was in 6th grade, being like, I come from the land of grunge, you know, whereas maybe when you guys were doing it, it was just sort of like, this is just, we're just having a good time. Like, it is not identified, you know, as something in particular. We haven't seen hype yet, you know, so like, we don't actually know what we're doing.
Well, we had no industry infrastructure. L.A. had a music industry, so bands had records, well-produced records, you know, and in the Bay Area, too, you know, you had bands like the Dead Kennedys and MDC and all these bands that were really well produced. And in L.A., I mean, the stuff that stands up from that era, as far as I go through my punk records, I got about 300 punk records in here. The stuff that stands up the best in many ways is some of that OC Southern California punk because it's so well produced. And the musicians, I think, were a little older generally, you know? Like the guys from Bad Religion and stuff, they're like 10 years older than me, but I was doing, you know, it was at the same time. But even all my friends from back then were like, you know, when Mark Arm and Steve Turner, those guys were like 21, 22. I was like 14, 15. So they were like big brothers. They were bigger than me. I mean, they treated me as an equal, but like, I think a lot of the California bands, some of them, the well-produced ones, were just older musicians. They were pros. And so the music holds up. Well, we had no recording infrastructure at that point, you know? I mean, we recorded in Jeff Ament's basement, you know? And what we'd do is it would be a one-track recording, so you couldn't do multiple tracks and stereo and stuff. So what we'd do is you'd set everybody's amp and the drummer, everybody in a different room, and sort of, you know, physically converge at the bottom of a stairwell in his basement with the instruments separated and mic'd in different rooms to achieve, like, you know, the closest we could get to sound separation and tracking. And actually, you know, some of the recordings are brilliant. Jeff was a brilliant, it was really smart. I tried to do it a few times for a few bands to me with not as good of, I wasn't as good at it.
That sounds insanely complicated, but it's one of those things where you find a solution, and sometimes the solution is, like, you know, cooler almost and sounds better than if you actually had the ability to record in stereo.
Well, I mean, you know, just look at Jack and Dino. I mean, Jack and Dino can take a 24-track studio and make it sound like Jeff Ament's basement, and that's kind of, I don't know, some might argue his goal in a lot of ways. I think it sounds complicated, but it's really a pretty simple concept. You know, you just have to separate the sounds of the different instruments so they're not all bleeding into each other. You know, back in the 40s, what they did, they had amazing omnidirectional mics and great rooms. They'd get, you know, they'd get a big band, they'd get 34 pieces into the same room and record on one mic live and just do 20 takes, you know. But once you start doing that with a punk band all in one room, you got instruments feeding back. It's impossible to regulate your levels. You know what I mean? If you record it, the drums are too loud, you're stuck with it. So if you separate everybody and you have a multi-channel mixer, then you can at least, you know, regulate people's volumes somewhat.
Well, tell me, as we're winding down, what your favorite memory of Seattle is from that era when you were living in the warehouse, 3,500 square feet for $200 a month.
Ah, well, that's a little later than the punk rock period, but of that period, I don't know. It was just the camaraderie. It was just the feeling that, you know, I was much more. Now I live up in the mountains, right? I'm a mountain man now. I don't need the city anymore. I'm not that interested.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm married and I have kids. But then I always thought I'd live in New York. You know, I was really into this urban. And living downtown and having, you know, 50 friends that live downtown, and all those clubs and all those bars, there was just always something going on, warehouse parties. You really felt like you were a part of something. And that's, you know, I think from the national perspective, like if you use a broader lens, I think that's what people probably thought Seattle was like in the late 90s, but or the early 90s, like 93, 94, when everything started to hit. When I think of that period, I just think of a lot of German tourists, you know, looking to touch the hem of Kurt Cobain's, you know, flannel shirt or something. The real scene to me was... it was just earlier, and if you just felt like you were a part of something, whether or not the rest of the world was paying attention, that's what I meant.
Well, we've been talking to Jonathan Evason, New York Times bestselling author, who's probably already written 3 books that aren't going to come out for like the next 10 or 15 years, but
I got one in a year, one in 3 years, and one in 5 years.
Man, that has to
I'm
feel
not trying
really
to write
good.
Historical fiction here, but.
Well, at least you have to feel like you're in a good place in terms of your output, and the problem actually becomes having to wait for all of us to get to read these things.
Yeah, for you the problem becomes, for me the problem is, like, what am I going to do financially for 2 years while I wait for this book published? And the answer is just write another book and sell it in the meantime.
You could start a band.
Oh yeah, I don't think so. I don't. I'm sorry. It's just. It's really sad to me. Even when I see Jello up there, like 30 pounds heavier, Jello Biafra, I'm kind of like, it just doesn't, I don't know. I couldn't do it. I was never very good anyway, but like the idea of me up there with it looking like a lactating gorilla, bald, paunchy, it just doesn't have the, it wouldn't match the lyrical content. Let me put it that way.
Well, then let me produce a talk radio show for you for on KPTZ. That pays the big bucks, let me tell you. We'll see.
Bring some sponsors with me too.
Yeah, oh, I
sponsors.
Bet you could.
Like that at Community Radio.
Yeah, we need you. We need you. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. I hope we can talk again in the next couple months, and I hope you stay sane and listen to records in your garage for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, man. Good stuff. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll talk to you again later.